there's an opening on the Supreme Court for you.
I have my robes ready. Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Marina Gorbis, Executive Director of the Institute for the Future, a 50-year-old nonprofit in Silicon Valley dedicated to systematically thinking about the future, and I will serve as your moderator today. I am thrilled to be here with Doug, somebody who I've admired and looked up to for years. He's an amazing person, Douglas Rushkoff. Doug is really somebody who's got his finger on cultural trends. He really knows what's coming. And the good thing is that he shares what he knows widely in films and lectures and books and many other mediums that he's on. What I always think of Doug is that he helps us make sense of the changes we see all around us in media and technology. He kind of puts these changes in a historical perspective and brilliantly connects them to our economic and social and political life today. It gives us a new kind of framework for looking at what's happening around us. And one thing that I particularly appreciate that he's been doing for decades now is really deconstructing media, kind of demystifying it in order to help us free ourselves of its control and to help us actually use media and technology tools to enrich our humanity and use it for our own needs and purposes. Doug Rushkoff is a professor of media theory and digital economics at the City University of New York's Queens College. And his latest book has a particular resonance to those of us who live in San Francisco and the Bay Area. It is called Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. And the basic question that he asks in the book is, why have these digital technologies not ushered in a new age of distributed prosperity, as many of us have really thought of and what the promise of this technology has been, and what can we do to actually reach that distributed prosperity? So great to have you. Welcome, Doug Rushkoff. And let's start with that question. What went wrong? We thought these technologies will usher this new age of prosperity and distribution, and it's going to empower everybody. And it empowered some, right, but not everybody. So what went wrong here?
Well, I'm cutting to the chase. What went wrong is that the people building digital tools and digital companies didn't recognize that they were working on top of another operating system, you know, and that was the operating system of corporate capitalism. You know, and it's funny because they're programmers. You would think programmers recognize an operating system when they see one. Right? They recognize Unix versus Macintosh versus Windows. But, I mean, think about it. If you lived in a world where every computer had the Macintosh operating system, you would no longer know there's such a thing as an operating system. You would think that's just computer. And that's sort of what's happened is companies, they start sometimes with actually great ideas. Like, two kids in a Stanford dorm room look at Yahoo and say, that's a really stupid way to organize the world's information, to have a bunch of people coming up with tables of contents and all. What if we just made an algorithm that looked at what people link to and how they all link together and created a bottom-up index of everything that's online? Wouldn't that be cool? And wouldn't it be more distributive and democratic and interesting? And they build this thing, and it kind of works. And then they think, as everyone did back then, you know, the people who were programmers in the early days, in the early 90s, late 80s, if you went and became a computer programmer, your parents were upset for you. They thought that you were just some Dungeons and Dragons video game geek and you were going to throw your life away to be some hacker person. And We did that for years like that. And just getting by, living on pizza, trading shareware and freeware and getting a buck here and a buck there. And some people who came up with interesting ideas, eventually money people came, whether it was AT&T or Sequoia Capital or someone, and said, hey, kid, this is something real. And I don't blame a young hacker who's gotten no acknowledgement from his parents' generation to say, yay, I'm being recognized. This is going to be a real company. Yes, I'm going to take that money. I'm going to take that valuation. Look, Ma, I have a successful company. And what they didn't realize is that by taking venture capital, they were actually selling their companies. And they were selling their companies to people who really didn't care, particularly after the dot-com boom and bust, after they had been burned by the internet once. Now the people who were buying these companies, investing in them, they wanted to make sure these companies delivered. Right? So the companies themselves became, if anything, they became almost the names, the brands on new models of extraction. So what a venture capitalist does once he buys a company, once he invests in that company, and I use he because they're pretty much all guys, I'm not using it the grammatical he, but the actual he, what they do is they help that company do this thing called pivoting, right? They help that company pivot. And what it means when a company pivots is the company has to abandon whatever its original dream was of creating value for people and instead figure out a way to get to acquisition or IPO within 18 to 24 months. And in order to do that, you need to progress very differently, much more rapidly. What you do is you progress towards a more scorched earth policy. So now what you do is you look at your marketplace and you think, how can I extract value from this marketplace as quickly as possible? You adopt a scorched earth approach to your market. So instead of trying to create a sustainable market, a sustainable economy around an application, you look at the industry that you want to disrupt more like a vacuum cleaner looks at dirt. You know, you look at it and you think, how can I suck all the value out of this thing and establish what's called a platform monopoly? How do I establish a monopoly over this whole industry so then I can then move into another vertical, another industry, and another industry, and another industry? So you look at something like Uber, which may have started, who knows, it may have started as a legitimate effort. Oh, we're going to help people give each other rides. But then once you get a few $1 million or tens of millions or hundreds of millions, or in their case, $1 billion of venture capital, it's no longer about helping people get rides. It's about totally dominating the taxi industry so you can pivot into another vertical like logistics or drones or automatic cars or robots or something else. Do you think Amazon went into books because they care about reading and promoting publishing and helping writers reach? No, it was to establish, they looked at the weakest industry on the block, and believe me, I'm a writer, I know. Books is the weakest industry, the vulnerable, low-hanging fruit, and saying, we can establish a platform monopoly in books because that's such a vulnerable, non-growth industry. We can just take that one and then use that monopoly to move over into something else or something else or something else. So there's a lot of reasons how this started, but even the venture capitalists don't understand, or maybe they do, but don't want to see it, that they're employing an industrial age model of corporatism on a digital platform, on digital economies. So the thing that Walmart might have done to every town where it goes, and it takes, what, 20, 30, 40 years for Walmart to completely bankrupt a town to the point where now they're closing in a lot of towns because they closed all the local businesses, they don't give people a decent wage, and they run out of customers. That thing which normally took 30, 40 years to do, you can do in 30, 40 days, practically, when you're amped up on digital steroids and you have all of these new tools through which to extract money. So really what we're looking at is the end of the industrial age. And we've known for 75 years, corporate growth over net value has been going down. That is, the corporate profit, corporations' ability to make a profit has been going down relative to their size. So that means corporations are really good at sucking all of the value out of something, but then really bad at making more money, really bad at deploying the capital that they've accumulated. So they're like it's a kind of obesity where they store capital in fat, but don't have the muscle to do things. So then if we take digital companies and we direct them to do more of that, then we end up with companies like Uber or Amazon or even Google, which are pretty much just software designed to extract value from people and places and turn it into share price. And they have to do that. So Twitter, which is a company I love, or at least an application I love, Twitter makes $500 million a quarter on a 140-character messaging app. Should be a success, right? Isn't that pretty good for 140 characters? No, but this is considered an abject failure by Wall Street because there's so many billions of dollars have been invested by people who want 100x or 1,000x return on their investment that they are going to force Twitter to pivot and to become a video company, a news agency, God knows what, in order to somehow become as big as Facebook, which they really, I don't know if they can't do it. I don't think they can, but they shouldn't do it. They shouldn't be forced to do it. So we end up in this situation where even if a founder had a great idea for something that could have generated wealth in a distributed fashion, they're not allowed to do that because of the old rule set on which they're operating.
So speaking of operating systems, and what you're bringing up is very much part of Silicon Valley's operating system, mm-hmm. And people have written about it, that it's kind of a unique and very dynamic system where countercultural ideas and sort of social idealism and money and VCs all come together. You know, John Markov wrote the famous book, Where's the Dormouse Said, where a lot of these ideas come out. If you think about like Jobs and Wozniak, it was all about distributing power to the people. It was anti-supercomputers. Mm-hmm. Everybody's going to have a computer. And every one of those, whether it's Twitter or I'm not sure about Uber, but everybody else, starts with this really idealistic kind of notion that we can do things in completely new ways and in distributed ways, and somehow it gets co-opted, and the end result is that we end up with both. Like if you think about sharing economy and the promise of that, there's a lot of that, but on the other side, we have this kind of extreme marketization. So now that everything that I could give you as a gift, right, I'm going to share it on the platform and sell it to somebody or rent it to somebody. So is it possible to change operating systems in this kind of environment? I know you have several sort of suggestions for what we should be doing, but it's a deeply embedded system that produces some really great things, and yet it kind of goes to its kind of extreme. It creates these unfortunate externalities, or they've quickly become internalities.
Yeah, I mean, and San Francisco knows as well as anyone. I mean, thus the title of this book, you know, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus. And it's not that I'm arguing that we should throw rocks at the Google Bus, but we all identify with the frustration that people have about, wait a minute, this company, these companies that came from here, these companies that used that leveraged the goodwill, the historical sharing, leftist, hippie sharing values of the Bay Area, of San Francisco, have essentially appropriated that ethos for completely extractive corporatist purposes. So that now, as we know, the rents in San Francisco have skyrocketed. If you're near one of the Google bus stops, it's 30% higher than it is even everywhere else where it's elevated. And what's happened, it's almost, I mean, yeah, and then I'll get to the solution, which is really, which is the
and
problem.
I want you to get into McLuhan's four rules, because some of it is like taking to extreme, right? And these unfortunate things happen, but finish your thought.
Right. I guess I lost my thought anyway.
Oh, well. Okay, let's just go into McLuhan then.
Yeah, I mean, you know, well, what I do, it's funny, because, you know, you were talking before about how I'm a media theorist, which I am, and I look at media and try to deconstruct them and understand how they function. And what I realized was that money is just another medium. Money is just, you know, central currency is an operating system. So if I want to understand money and the corporation as an operating system and essentially a piece of software, why don't I apply the tools of the media theorist? So you can use, McLuhan has something called the tetrad, where you look at what does this medium amplify, what does this medium, what does it repress, what does it retrieve, and what does it flip into when it reaches its extreme. So, you know, you could look at the corporation and say, well, what does corporation amplify? Well, it amplifies the power of central authorities. What does it retrieve? It retrieves the corporation. It retrieves really the values of ancient Rome and Greece, you know, the imperialism of the early chartered corporations. What does it repress? Well, it repressed the peer-to-peer economy that was rising at the end of the late Middle Ages that led to tremendous prosperity through marketplaces and peer-to-peer currencies, local currencies, and trading. And what does it flip into? Well, when it's pushed to the extreme, it flips into personhood, which is what it did. Now they have the rights of people. They can vote. They can, you know, they can do everything. They have their rights. You know, or I look at the underlying operating system. You know, where did that come from? Where did central currency and this growth-based economy come from? And again, I look back to the late Middle Ages. Well, people had all these local currencies. They were getting wealthy, and the aristocracy was getting poor. So what did they do? And we call it the Renaissance. It was really, wasn't such a great thing. What they did was they made small businesses illegal. They invented the chartered monopoly. What does the chartered monopoly mean? It means you can't be in the shoe business anymore. You've got to go work for His Royal Shoe Majesty's company. You have to go work for the company. That's when we started selling our time, selling our hours, and became wage laborers instead of creating value and exchanging it. You know, or you look at the invention of central currency, which was forced. This was not some great evolutionary innovation. Central currency was what they did when they said, no, all of your local market monies that are all optimized for trade and the velocity of money and letting you all get rich, those are all now officially illegal. Now you have to borrow money from the central treasury and pay it back at interest if you want to do business. Well, that's a weird thing to set up. If you have to borrow money from the central treasury and then pay it back at interest, that means now you have an economy that is required to grow. Because where does the other money come from? And well, it worked well for colonial powers expanding into South America and North America and Africa. As long as you have more resources to pillage and more peoples to enslave, you can grow. You know, and we grew right up until about Eisenhower's time, when nations started pushing back, when we reached the limits of the planet. And that's when Vannevar Bush wrote, As We May Think. That's when the technologists came and said, ah, you may have reached the limits of the physical earth, but thanks to digital technology, we can now increase the surface area, if you will, of the planet. And now we can mine other things. We can colonize human attention and human time because we have no more space. And that's when we ended up with this always on insane extractive bias of our digital technology. So we're still using technology to really double down on a expansionist operating system that had reached its natural endpoint. You know, say what you like about, you know, positive or negative about corporate expansion. It was done. It was done, and the net came along, like you said, and we thought, ooh, this is going to be interesting. Now we can start trading. We can start doing things. We can have cottage industries. I have the means of production in my own home. Digital meant digit. These are the digits. These are the original digits. Digital meant we're going to get hands-on again. And we started to see, you know, Burning Man and crafts and peer-to-peer and Etsy and eBay. And we're all going to get back into actually making stuff. Whole Earth Catalog, you know, married perfectly with that ethos of digital culture. You know, but we didn't take it there. And we can bring that back one way or the other. We're going to bring that back either because they're going to so bankrupt the economy that we have to turn to one another. When we realize that all you really need for an economy is people with needs and people with skills and the ability for them to transact. And thanks to the net and things like the blockchain, even we have a way to do authenticated transactions in a peer-to-peer fashion without those central authorities. It's just a matter of whether we have the wherewithal to do that, whether we have enough trust and faith, really, in our communities and in our ability to provide for one another, to do that the good old-fashioned, or, as I would argue, new-fashioned way. And we can begin to think, as we do our startups or as we retool big corporations, we can start optimizing not for the extraction of value and its conversion into capital, but start optimizing again for the velocity of money. Every person who's starting a startup, every person who has a digital company should be thinking, how can I make my users rich? How can I make the others rich? Rather than the more traditional corporate mindset of how can I get their money? You know, how can I extract value from this situation? It's rather, how can I circulate it? It's thinking about things much more in the manner of a family business. When you run a family business, you're not thinking, how can I make enough money to give my kid an inheritance of cash? You're thinking, how can I create a business that's so sustainable, that is so organically tied to a community and so loved that it's still there for my grandchildren so they can run it, so they can be a part of it. And if you look at the metrics, family businesses do better on every single metric than shareholder-owned businesses, except one. Family businesses don't grow as fast during a bubble. And that's actually a metric that you prefer not to have. You know, if you grow big during a bubble, then you crash during that bubble. So really what I've done in the book is tried to give people lots and lots of models. How do you stress dividends instead of capital gains? Then you got to look at the tax system. Why do we have a tax system that punishes people who earn money and rewards people who just receive it passively? What is that optimized for? You know, that's not optimized for the velocity of money. So we can start looking at really practical, simple, incremental steps that we can take to re-steer this thing towards circulation. Doing bounded investing, doing local investing, doing what the Teamsters do with their retirement fund. You know where they invest their retirement fund? In projects that hire Teamsters. Duh. You know, what is that? They're not taking their money out and throwing it into a Philippines mining company or into the S&P. They're putting the money to work so they earn the same dollar 2, 3, 4 times. And that's the way you have to start thinking of business, is how do I not get $10 and pull it out of the system, but how do I see that same dollar 10 different times? And that's just it's a small flip. But once they do that, then we get the distributed prosperity that this technology, that's more consonant with digitally networked technologies than the opposite. Digital technology is burning out corporatism. That's what we're watching. It's burning out. So it's going to go away one way or the other. We could just make it make a peaceful transition or a more radical one.
So there are a couple of questions here, and you mentioned the magic word. So I'm going to go to blockchain and Bitcoin, where similar kind of rhetoric around that, around how promises of decentralizing, distributing power, distributing everything, getting banks out of the system, getting rid of central currencies. What are your thoughts on blockchain and Bitcoin? And you write about it in the book. Is it another hype?
Yes and no. I mean, once you see the Winklevoss brothers running towards something, you know to go away, right? These are the guys, the original Facebook investors. Once they start an ETF for Bitcoin, you know that something is wrong with this picture, right? So, Bitcoin, you really got, when you look at something, again, as a media theorist, what are they solving for? What are they solving for? You know, anonymous cryptographic transactions. What are you solving for here exactly? You know, and I don't think they were solving for the right problem. You know, Bitcoin is really good. It's not engendering trust between people. Bitcoin is substituting for trust in a new way, but it's still substituting for trust. The part that gets interesting about Bitcoin is, and it is a little hyped, but it's still really interesting, is the blockchain. Now, the thing I like about the blockchain is the blockchain lets people authenticate things without a central authority. So we don't need the Fed. We don't need the automated clearinghouse. We don't need SWIFT. We don't need to pay up to a central authority in order for me to know that you sent me and I sent you. We use a public ledger. So there's two ways to keep a street safe at night, right? One is to have lots of guns, and the other is to have lots of traffic. have a lot of witnesses. If there's a lot of street traffic, then your street is safe because everybody is there. The blockchain uses that principle. If everybody's witnessing this open, transparent ledger, and we all are participating in that, then we can authenticate things in a peer-to-peer way. I think that Bitcoin, just by being able to do that, it puts the traditional authenticators and gatekeepers on notice. Just the fact that we have the ability to do it without them should change the way they look at their exclusive province over authentication of things. I've got no problem with central authorities. We can use you don't have to do everything with a blockchain. We can have a worker-owned cooperative of cab drivers. You don't have to use a blockchain in order to authenticate how much should he drive, how much should he drive, to make sure that the platform's not going to extract too much. You can trust people, you know, and you can look at what they're doing. You don't need to resort necessarily to cryptography to engender trust, but the fact that we can do it sort of restores our own faith in our ability to do these things. Where I get concerned is sort of more in the direction, you know, that Jaron Lanier might argue, where he would say that there's all these things that we do that aren't being counted. So we could get everything on the books with blockchains and these technologies, so that any piece of information that's used, so you doing this with me now, helping me with my book, now we're going to figure out how to measure that and get that in the record, so then that I do something. It's like, come on. I mean, at a certain point, I'm more interested in getting stuff off the books than getting it on, getting people bound in community and doing stuff for each other, rather than having a metric for everything, because the metrics don't work in the end. In the end, I mean, that's the really dirty secret about digital technologies. Our books never really made money. It was always kind of fudged. Now that they have BookScan and they can count how many books I've sold, it's like, oops, you know, now we're in trouble, you know? The whole point was just you move publisher to publisher and is that okay? And there's enough fudge, and it just all kind of kept going based on faith and our desire to do things. Once you have it, the numbers, well, look at your numbers. Your numbers aren't there. I don't have the hit count. I don't have this. Everything is so verified that we lose the wiggle room and the ambiguity to just sort of get away with stuff. And I don't mean to cheat, but just to get on, you know? The object of the game in the late 80s was to create slack. That's what we called it. We were slackers. How do we make time so we can read philosophy instead of going to, you know, Payne Weber and doing some horrible job? How do we get that slack, that wiggle room that makes for community and makes for fun? And once we have a metric for everything, we kind of lose that wiggle room, or we mistake the map for the territory. We mistake those metrics for what's actually happening rather than just it's two-column accounting. Again, another Renaissance-era innovation from the Moors that was a zero-sum way of understanding business that helped industrialism. It helped disconnect people from the value they created. It helped disconnect labor from the fruits of their work, but it really didn't necessarily help humanity negotiate a more nuanced set of relationships.
Right. And we're kind of in the central of the extreme quantification movement here. Everybody's wearing, this is the whole quantified
exactly.
movement.
There's an algorithm
I was
for
just,
that.
Yeah, yeah, I was just reading the study that showed the people, and I'm sure everybody here wears one of the Fitbits or some other thing, that once you start calculating that, you do improve how many steps you take, but it becomes work and you get less pleasure out of it. So to your point that the more we quantify, the more it becomes like work and the less it becomes ambiguous and pleasure.
Right. Particularly if the people enabling the quantification are doing it purely in order to extract value from people and to grow their ledgers. Because really what they're doing is extracting working money. They're extracting what we use to transact and trapping it in frozen share price. That's how they kill a marketplace. They take all the poker chips off the table so we have nothing left to transact with. Yet we still have skills, we still have needs, we still want to do stuff for each other, we just don't have the cash with which to do it. You know, and our politicians still, they're so, this is where Trump is right, they're so establishment in their thinking that even in Obama, we put him in office during a financial crisis, and what does he think? He thinks, okay, I gotta convince the banks to lend money to corporations so they can build factories and give people jobs. making stuff that nobody even wants and that's plastic crap that we're going to stick in a storehouse. Meanwhile, we're tearing down houses in California. Bank of America tears them down every day because they're in foreclosure. Can't just let someone live in that house. Why? Because that guy doesn't have a job. You know, so what is the purpose of jobs? It's not in order to get stuff done that we need. The purpose of having a job is so we can justify letting you partake of the spoils of industrial capitalism. This is ass backwards. You know, and that's what we need to change. That's what we need to get to, whether we're using guaranteed minimum income, which even Nixon wanted, because he understood, well, look, if we have enough stuff, then let people have a home, let people have food, let people have health care, and then let them play this gamified market game in order to get the luxuries. What people don't realize is the marketplace is not something that you gamify. It's already gamified. That's what it is. It was a game. Here's the money we use. It's going to be fixed. You get it from this bank. Here's how you earn it. It's already gamified. You don't need to go to the metagame. You need to understand that it's a game and we can change the rules now to make it more fun and prosperous for the people playing it.
So given that,
yeah.
All of that, all these small things, where do we go from here? What gives you hope? What are you seeing in the world and in around you, whether it's new ways of doing things? You mentioned platform cooperatives.
I mean, platform cooperatives give me hope. You know, this is like...
Say more about that.
You know, platform cooperatives, it would basically be if you took Uber and decided that the drivers own the platform instead of these shareholders. Because it didn't cost that much to make Uber. All the money that's in Uber is really there just to deregulate and undercut and do nasty business things. They don't need it to function. You could build that app pretty inexpensively. So if the drivers owned the app, or if they own 10%, 20% of the app, now they're no longer doing R&D for the automatic cars that will replace them in 10 years. Now they're doing R&D for the automatic cars that they will be owning in 10 years, and that will be creating income for them as the people who did the initial research for this. So a platform cooperative, it's really just that. It's a cooperative, but in a digital sense, because it works on a platform. It's the same model that Winco is using to bring down Walmart right now. Winco is a big box sort of supermarket chain that's owned by the workers. And it actually has as good, in some cases, better prices than Walmart. And everyone on Wall Street's so confused. How can you pay your workers more and give them shares in the company and still have better prices than Walmart? It's because they don't have the overhead of shareholders. They don't have to give 90% of their revenue away into share price. It's actually a better model. You know, and it's generative, and the workers like it, and the customers like it. So those kinds of things give me hope. But what gives me the most hope are people who realize that they don't need the universal solution for everything. And, you know, I still get so many emails from kids, smart, sweet kids, who want to do something good for the world. And they say, oh, what I want your help with, I want to write the code to build a website that will aggregate all the websites of people who are doing good social solutions to local economic problems. It's like, well, why do you want to build the website to aggregate all the, why don't you just do one of the solutions to local problems? You know, instead, because they have this still, it's that industrial age, one size fits all, I'm going to do the meta thing. Or they come up with a solution that works locally, but they want to know, how am I going to scale this? Don't scale it. Scale is the obligation of growth-based corporations, but it's a nightmare. You don't want to scale. Instead, what you want to do is sustain at a functional, operational level. If you haven't borrowed money, if you don't have a ridiculous debt structure, you don't need to scale. You can actually make revenue. This is the same thing I say to the, you know, the Fortune 100 companies, that the CEOs of these companies, they are crying with me. They cry with me in their offices because they have these growth targets they have to meet, and they're cannibalizing their own companies in order to do it. And the ones who cry are the ones who actually care about their businesses and say, oh my God, I can't do another one-time write-off. I just can't do it. I can't sell another one of my productive businesses in order to create the illusion of growth for shareholders who are demanding that and giving them bonuses based on it, when it's killing the actual business or the marketplace that they want to develop. So even they can shift. They can move towards giving people dividends instead of capital gains if they can then lobby tax law to change. So instead of punishing dividends, we punish capital gains. There's a lot of ways to do that. But the thing that gives me hope are people who are doing little things. I'm opened a farm. I'm doing community supported agriculture by subscription. I created a restaurant. I have a local bookstore that was crowdfunded by my community. You know, those are the things that give me hope, are the people who have set their sights on something different, who have gotten off the fame wagon. You're not going to get 200,000 followers on Instagram with your locally sustainable, functional business. And even if it's not physically local, which I still think is the best, I think human beings are at their best when they utilize the home field advantage of planet Earth. This is where we have the home field advantage and corporations don't. They are still alien entities, particularly internet companies. They are not here. That's why those Google buses are so weird, right? It's the aliens coming, and then they go back, and they come, and they go back. It's like that To Serve Man episode of The Twilight Zone. They're just pulling the people off.
However,
yes.
If you,
the voice
if you,
of reason.
I'm just wondering. It's not a level playing field. You mentioned Walmart, right? And a local grocery store. We're seeing it every day. Or it's Uber versus, and it doesn't have to be Uber, but any of the large platforms that are highly capitalized, that got billions of dollars in investment money, versus somebody who is trying to do small scale, local, ride share, whatever you, it's not a level playing field. So it's very, how do you get out of this that the game actually has not been set? The rules of the game are not set for small scale and all of these other ways, local. It's very, very hard for these kind, whenever I talk to people about co-ops, which is a great idea and worker owned companies, that comes to that. It's very hard to succeed in that game if the playing field is not level.
No, and it's even harder than it used to be, because in the old days, labor could forge solidarity because you were sitting next to somebody on the assembly line and going to the bar with them afterwards. Now, if you're an Amazon Mechanical Turk worker or an Uber driver, they don't have a chat function on there to talk to the other drivers to form, oh, you want to form a union? You're not going to find the other people on Amazon Turk. There is no, lateral connection. But what has to happen is it gets to a point where you really, I can no longer be bled by this app. That working for Uber is making me poorer rather than wealthier. There's a point at which you just have to stop and say, this one isn't working anymore. So yeah, they are advantage. They're advantage in terms of scale, but they're not always advantage in terms of food sourcing is a really good one. Food sourcing is something that you can start to do locally and cheaper than big agri. You know, especially as their forced externalities of roads and other things. They don't want to pay for infrastructure now anyway, so how are they going to ship that stuff across the country? You know, they if they're going to cut off their taxes and not invest in the infrastructure that even keeps them going, then they're not going to last that long. These large corporate giant supply chains are crumbling under their own weight. You know, and yes, you know, on the one hand, millennials, the millennial generation is more willing to look at the cost of something rather than just the price of something. You know, if you realize that, oh, I could buy it at Walmart a dollar cheaper, but it's going to cost me $3 more in the long run. You know, as people are able to do that, and as local businesses are able to actually do better, you know, and gosh, well, once we have local currencies, once people start, we're using Bay Bucks here now, are people using those? Once you have local currencies, you start taking away a whole lot of the advantage of the large companies, because now you can get the money as cheap or cheaper. Local currency is earned into existence. You don't even try to accumulate it. You just do stuff. It just happens. It's a spontaneous currency. It's real time. It's more like RAM than the hard drive. So there are ways to do it. But again, it's starting super small and then getting that example. So it's the local pizzeria. You know, when it needs an expansion, it can go to the bank and get money and get capital and have to pay it back. Or it could go to its community and say, hey, if you pay me $100 now, I'll give you a coupon that's worth $120 worth of pizza once the expansion is done. You're getting 20% return on your money, and you're going to see the effect of your investment on your town. And I get to pay back in pizza, which is a lot cheaper for me than money. So now you've made your main street better. You've made the restaurant better. You've increased your property value. You've increased the tax base. You've made your public schools better. And you start to see all that money circulating rather than just coming out of the town. And then you talk to the bank and say, hey, bank, maybe you give me half the loan, and the other half, now the bank can start doing facilitation of crowdfunding. They can start providing value to a community, helping communities reinvest in themselves, much in the fashion of credit unions, and they'll be looked at less with less hostility than they are now, because most of us understand that banks, again, function more like vacuum cleaners, extracting value from our communities rather than helping us circulate it.
Okay.
I mean, it's a toughie, right? We may not win, but the reason why we will eventually get the opportunity to do this is because Uber is more like Clear Channel. You know, where Clear Channel came in and bought the FM dial and destroyed the whole thing and then realized they can't make money because it's not really a growth business, the same as books or records or any of these things these corporations bought, and then they abandon it. So now FM can slowly kind of come back. We can take the stations, we get the bandwidth, we get the frequencies. I mean, the problem is they destroyed an ecosystem that took 40 years of FM radio to develop. So it's really hard to rebuild it that fast. But that's why we have to start now. Meet your neighbors, develop community relationships, start transacting with people, you know, provide for one another, relearn mutual aid. And then we will be in a position to pick up the pieces when they go bankrupt, which they will.
This is a reminder for our radio audience. This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking to Douglas Rushkoff, professor of media theory and digital economics at the City University of New York's Queens College.
Pitch the book.
And Doug is the author of Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. And I'm Marina Gorbis, Executive Director of the Institute for the Future in California, Silicon Valley, and I'm your moderator for today.
You know, the my pitch for this book is that this is not, I mean, and it's hard, this is not as easy as an overnight update of your phone operating system. You know, there is no tweet for this. I've tried. I can't do this in 140 characters. This took 400 or 500 years of corporate capitalism to happen. You know, just as the Jews spent 40 years in the desert before they got to Canaan, what I'm asking,
I knew it was gonna get
is
to that.
Spend 4 or 5 hours. It takes 4 or 5 hours to really get the argument I'm making and to experience enough of the models I'm talking about to be able to apply them. I can't give you the solution. What I can do, and I do, is give maybe 20 examples of ideas for how we could do this, because in a post-industrial age, there is no one-size-fits-all model solution. There are thousands, millions of distributed individual solutions, each perfect for its own location and its own community. And once we realize that you come up with the particular solution for your place, that's how you beat these guys, because they have universal single solutions, monocultural solutions, where we can have the real ones, the particular ones that actually serve individual marketplaces better.
This is an interesting question from the audience. So Walmart buys locally, using massive scale logistics to collect and sell food. So corporations can adapt methods of local ownership while still extracting wealth. Thoughts on that? What do you see there?
Yeah, I mean, Walmart buys locally in a way. You know, the same way that Whole Earth Whole Food nods to localism. I mean, the problem is, and then who's it? What's it, the restaurant that got in trouble for
Chipotle
bought locally? Oh no, now they had some salmonella or whatever in their food, or E. coli, and now, you see, local's bad. Great. No, local is really hard when you are a multinational corporation. It's much harder to source locally, because locally doesn't happen at scale. That's the whole point. Locally happens locally. So it's in a sense, it's inappropriate. That's not what you do. If you're going to source things locally, then you do it with a local business. You do it with a small local store that knows how to work locally in a human-to-human way and can adjust for the changes in weather and the road is closed. And this, it works because you're part of the living community together. You know, big businesses, I'm not saying they all go away. You know, we're still going to need cars and bridges and things that big corporations and multinational supply chains can provide, but we will become more conscious. I mean, I'm sure the people in this room are more conscious of the fact of where does the stuff in my cell phone come from? Are little African children sent into caves to get the rare earth metals to make this phone? Yes, they are. I mean, and when I upgrade my phone, you know, can I use something like Fairphone and get little components for it rather than buying a whole new phone and sending more people into those caves to get that stuff? Do I understand that my phone is using 2 refrigerators worth of electricity? Not when I plug it in, but on all the servers and things I'm pulling on? Or has the phone been designed to make it look like this is a super clean little piece of technology and help me, just like the corporations that made this phone, not see the economic and ecological devastation? Again, this is what happens. Land, labor, and capital are the 3 factors of production. From Adam Smith forward, we've understood that. And now we have an economic operating system that's only rewarding capital. So what happens? The land gets destroyed, right? Our environment's going away. And labor ends up disenfranchised, which is us, without any jobs and any ways to make a living. You know, so all we have to do is reincorporate land and labor as mutual partners in this equation, and everything slowly gets better.
So you teach at a college?
I teach.
You have an 11-year-old, right?
And an 11-year-old.
So what do you tell your students and your daughter? What should they know, study? What should they be in college? What advice do you have? And what do they want, you think?
I mean, I think college really has the same role as art, you know, which is to help you step out of the cultural narrative and see it as a social construction rather than as a condition of nature. So it can be the cultural narratives about race and gender and ethnicity. It could be the cultural narrative about the political economy, so that you learn Marx and Hegel and John Stuart Mill.
That's the best explanation, actually, I've heard about why people should go to college. It's not about getting a job. It's not about...
Well, we've reversed it, right? As corporate capitalism took over education now, even well-meaning universities, they'll say, oh, well, we're having all these conversations with industry to find out what skills your students are going to need in the marketplace so we can train our kids for the jobs of today and the jobs of tomorrow. You don't want to train kids for the jobs of today and tomorrow. You want to train kids to invent the jobs of tomorrow. You know, it's sad, but the more economic pressure we have, the more we want, well, the more desperate we are to make sure they have those skills. But those skills you can get in community college. Those skills you can get by buying an O'Reilly book. Those skills you can get on the job. I mean, job skills? Who wants a job anyway, as we discussed already? A job is the excuse to get the spoils of capitalism that are already there. You know, a job is essentially to go into a cubicle and find something useless to do that has a metric. So no, it's not about getting a job. Going to college should be about figuring out a way.
Thanks for describing 99% people who have jobs.
No, it should be about figuring out a way to get through this world without needing a job. You know, that's the joy of it. But if nothing else, it's to have a personality. It's to have a way of thinking. It's to become an enriched, full, living, smart human being. The even college, you know, I mean, yeah, it used to just be for country club people, but education was something, a gift that industry gave to workers so they wouldn't live an utterly meaningless life between diving into the coal mines or whatever it was that we were supposed to be doing. Isn't it nice? Shouldn't human beings know how to read? Shouldn't human beings have that? Yeah, And right now we're at a juncture in society where we need as much intelligence as possible. We need as many people to be woken up from this nightmare, this 500-year-old nightmare about the way labor and capital and money and the world works, so that we can survive as a species. I mean, we're playing with fire here. This is a really tricky moment. It really is, and it's going to take independent individual thinkers, nonconformists, anomalous behavior to do that. We are configuring every one of our social workers, that's a good one, every one of our social platforms is currently configured to reduce human spontaneity. That's what big data is for. To look at your past, figure out what category you're in, get with 80% accuracy if they're going to know if you're going to decide you're gay or if you're going to decide to go on a diet, and then get that 80% number up by filling your social media feed with stuff. Oh, you're fat. You better go on a diet. Get that 80% up to 90 or 95% because they will make more money the more predictable we are. But the more predictable we are, the less variation, the less ideas, the less of that Darwinian natural selection weirdness stuff, human ambiguity that we need to think our way out of this drone-like despair and this lemming-like march off the cliff. And no, you will not become a billionaire if you build these alternative platforms. But what about becoming a millionaire? Isn't that still kind of cool? You can become a millionaire. You know, you don't want to be a billionaire because then you end up just figuring out, how am I going to put this back in? That's what Bill Gates is, Bill and Melinda Gates. How do we get the money back in circulation? And even little Mark Zuckerberg, bless his heart. I'm going to give 90% of my money back. If you're saying you're going to give 90% of your money back, it means you took too much to begin with. You know?
Do you sometimes feel like you are pushing? I don't mean you're throwing rocks at the Google bus, but you're pushing like this giant, giant stone.
Yeah, and I am.
And who else is doing it?
Oh, everybody in this room is doing it in our own way. We're all doing it. And, you know, if nothing else, when the Martian archaeologists come here after we're all gone, they're going to see that some of us understood what was happening, that it wasn't, we weren't all crazy, you know? And that's even that is a little bit worth it. I mean, yeah, I mean, I agree. I was a kind of more of a techno-optimist until I had a kid. And, you know, and part of the reason I had a kid was, I mean, it sounds diabolical, but part of the reason I had a kid and got married and wanted to live a normal human's life was to test my ideas about how everything was against reality. It's easy for me to talk about, oh, go cyber, when I'm just this independent guy who gets paid to go say go cyber. I mean, you get paid a whole lot more for saying things that are consonant with corporate capitalism than for saying what I say. You know, you can be on the long tail and try to get those $10,000 and $20,000 talks. You don't get those $10,000 and $20,000 talks for going to communities and talking to them about how to raise smarter kids or how to resist the pull of corporate capitalism or how not to take jobs. You know, that's not how to do it.
But you do go and you talk to Google and Facebook and others, right? And
I do, but that's because they're scared.
And do you give the same speech?
I was right enough times, right? I was the guy who got his book canceled in 1992 because Bantam thought the internet would be over by 1993 when my first book on the net was supposed to come out. I was the guy who talked about media viruses, which then became viral media. I was the guy who said, after the dot-com, don't worry, we're going to discover that the internet is actually a social medium, which then became this awful social media thing. I'm sorry, but I was right about enough things that particularly corporations who know that they're about to go off a cliff are willing to listen and say, okay, is there something we can do? And then what I pitch to them, and anybody who has a real job, this is what you can't turn around your corporation on a dime. You can't just turn them from an extractive corporation into a regenerative one. But what you can do is argue for a little pilot program. What if we do a little experiment? You know, or you just put, you know, what if we, at our big supermarket chain, what if we open it for farmers markets on Sundays, just to see what happens. What if it's a bank? We give half the money in a loan, and then we facilitate local crowdsourcing for the other half. Isn't that a good PR? That we're, you know, just come up with those little ideas, and then as the corporation sees, oh wow, we can actually generate revenue and not be hated, then they might try it in other places. So little pilot programs you can do. Think small, you know, and small in aggregate ends up pretty big. And big doesn't work anyway, as we're seeing.
And what about your own social media? Do you use social media?
Yeah. Well, Twitter counts. I use Twitter. I don't use Facebook. Facebook, I only want to use platforms that I understand. Because I believe if you don't understand how a platform works, then it's more likely you're being used by the platform than you're its user. You know, we walk around with these smartphones, and every swipe that you make on your smartphone gets smarter about you, and you're getting dumber about it. And I tend to try to use technologies that I understand who the customer is, that I understand what is the deal I'm making, what's happening here. And not only did I not understand Facebook, but even what I did understand about Facebook, I couldn't articulate succinctly enough to people who might follow me on there for me to be on there responsibly. If here I am talking about digital hygiene and maintaining an appropriate relationship with digital technology, I can't be on Facebook asking people for likes when they're going to end up flow through advertising and whatever else is going to come through it. So I'm, and I don't have time for this shit. I mean, sorry, on the radio, you bleep it. I just don't. I have so little time as it is trying to earn money to raise a family and all. What social media has taught me is that it is no substitute for forming rapport with real people, for making eye contact, for breathing, for conspiring. The word conspire, we even forgot. Conspire means to breathe with. Breathe, conspire, to breathe together with 10 people in a room. What do you get? The bandwidth is so high. Even Google Glass, that 3D, this is 3D already. It's immersive. It's total. I mean, just look, it tracks perfectly. You know, it's so cool. The resolution is just that I've come to appreciate that and to take, because I know I'm over 50. I only got so many years left. Something's going to happen and I'm going to die, right? I don't want to spend that time in the simulation when this is so, you know, it's just so rich. Digital is great for talking to people who are really far away, who you can't happen to get to. But the whole, you do it as fast as you can. It's asynchronous. Get off it and get back into life. You know, when it becomes the place that you are instead of life, then you got to make the world better. Make the world a place you want to be, you know, rather than a place you want to insulate yourself from. That's the same thing I say to the CEOs. They're trying to earn enough money so they can insulate themselves and their families from the realities of the world. I get that. You know, they're doing evil in their company so they can have a goat share and send their kid to Rudolf Steiner School. You know? But why not make the world a place where you would want your kids to actually be and spend that same effort, you know, spend that same effort that way to make yourself more porous and more sensitive to what's going on rather than build a better barrier?
There's a question here about your own profession. Well, I don't know how you define your profession, but about journalism and what's happening with that. And what are your thoughts on journalism and journalists as a profession?
The one great thing about the Donald Trump candidacy...
I was going to get to that, by the way.
...is it exposed market-driven journalism for what it is. They have, just as Facebook and Google and Uber have no choice but to deliver revenue into share price, CNN and MSNBC, they're in a ratings war, and we realize, oh my gosh, if the market is going to control journalism, the short-term market, then we're going to end up without journalism, without what journalism is. And I've had to make this argument. A lot of young people are like, well, why should you get paid for a blog post and I don't? No, why should anyone? Because anyone, we're all there, we all got cameras. If you're not... Corporations are paying public relations firms massive amounts of money to tell us stories that are untrue. We've got to pay a couple of journalists enough money to take a week or two to deconstruct those stories professionally and tell us what's actually going on. If we don't, then we have no idea what's happening. You know, you can, if you're going to live completely locally and not listen to anything, then okay, don't have journalism. Just trust the people in your tiny community. But we don't live on that scale. You've got to know what's going on. You know, and don't pretend, the other thing is don't pretend there's anything called balanced journalism. There's no such thing. You know, balanced journalism was an invention of the first national media. Because once we had national newspapers, national television, national radio, they needed to become balanced so they could get advertisers. Because you didn't want to advertise in something that was right-wing or left-wing, so we created this false balance. But wherever you put the fulcrum is where you decide the balance is. So now the balance on global warming is there global warming or not? That's not where we should put the fulcrum. We should put the fulcrum on, are we all going to die in 10 years or 100? You know, that's balanced journalism. So, So I do think people are realizing now, all right, we've screwed this thing up. And people are either going to become willing to pay for the journalism that we need to understand the world, or, I mean, I know it's talking about anything public, but understanding it as a public good, that we want to have public servants doing this, that we want to do what the Founding Fathers talked about, which was actually invest public money in the Fourth Estate, that could come back into vogue as we realize that without a Fourth Estate, we get no First Estate. You know, we have no public.
Right. So I know every time when you write a book, like you have ideas for your next thing, right? In the process of writing a book, you're probably asking yourself some other questions. What do you think after this?
I'm actually trying really hard not to for this one. My goal is after this book is out, I mean, I have a graphic novel coming out called Alistair and Adolf, and it's about an occult war at the end of World War II between Aleister Crowley and Adolf Hitler. Because, you know, it's fun, you know, Aleister Crowley is the guy that came up with the V is for Victory that Winston Churchill used to fight the salute. It was scissor beats paper. Was the idea. V is for Victory. And he also, and Winston Churchill didn't use it, he also came up with the thumbs up. But guess who did use the thumbs up? Right? Facebook. Yeah. Zuckerberg used the thumbs up, the like. So really what I do in the graphic novel is I'm arguing in a way that the fascists won the war and that the magical sigil-like technologies that were developed during World War II in that ideological war have been passed down to us as branding. So there's this sort of magical core to branding and a black magical, kind of a dark, destructive, anti-human a way of doing magic in order to promote brands. I mean, if I'm thinking long term about another book, the book is kind of this. I was thinking of calling it Everybody Knows, and it's in a way it's an answer to the whole privacy debate and the idea that thinking is no longer a personal activity, that you don't have your own idea or someone else has it. Everybody knows. And it's based on, I went to a conference called the Gel Conference in New York, and they had one of those lie detector guys. You know these people, and they line up people from the audience on stage, and they can tell who's lying and who's not and what. And I realized if this guy can read the cues that people are giving and tell if we're lying or not, it means that everybody, at least subconsciously, knows when everybody else is lying or not. So there's really no point in lying because they know that you're lying, even if they don't know it on the surface. People know it subconsciously. So if everybody knows, how would you act differently if everybody knows? It would be kind of fun because now there's no more, there's nothing to hide. There is no shame. Everybody knows. And to play with that as, you know, what does it mean as we move towards non-personal, non-owned ideas, non-owned thoughts? Your thoughts are not your own. They all belong to everybody because thinking is not a personal activity. We are all, it's very optimistic. It's the original rave, a psychedelic cyber idea. We are all neurons in a big global brain. And what if we started acting like that and just pretending it's true? It could lead to a very different organismic way of relating to each other. But I thought I would start with this sort of everybody knows idea and to see whether that, just as a thought bomb, everybody knows, does that make you scared or does it make you glad? Is it a relief? For me, it's a relief. Oh, everybody knows. Oh my God, everybody knows. You mean you all have masturbated? You know, it's like, oh my God, everybody knows. It's all happened. You know, you've all, you know, wished someone dead. You've all done that. We've all done all that. You know, so if we get to that place, then maybe we can start knitting the intellectual, and dare I say it, spiritual fiber that we need, the connective tissue that we need to begin behaving more organismically rather than individualistically. Is that the beginning of unwinding this, you know, century of the self that we're living in, which is the human side of corporatism? What corporatism thrives on is the illusion of individuality, the illusion of your separateness, which was invented in the Renaissance. Read Dr. Faustus. That's the first really individual character. That's when individuality, the individual perspective of perspective painting, reading, and the individual perspective on literature, the gentleman sitting alone in his room, private property, one man, one vote. All those ideas are the strident individualism of industrial culture. So if we begin to unwind that and say, wait a minute, individuality is the booby prize because it makes me alone. Conspiracy is the fun thing because we breathe together. And it's okay because everybody already knows. So if everybody knows where we're at, then where do we go next? What do we not know? Well, what we don't know is what we can do together. What we don't know is the potential possibilities of people doing things in concert. And that's where the human ambiguity, weird stuff gets in. We've analyzed the individual to death. We've done Freud. We know there's you, there's your subconscious, there's your sub-subconscious. It goes, and there's nothing there. Who cares? You know, there's nothing. It's your DNA, and that's just code. You know, where it gets interesting is when do you mix, you know? It's whether you mix sexually or whether you mix mimetically. That's the fun. That's the weird, wet, strange, intimate part that makes life fun. And it's the one thing that they can't replicate, that they can't simulate, and they can't charge you for.
Right? It's because so it's interesting. As you're talking, it's just like you have this feeling like it's the greatest thing in the world and the possibilities, and it's also a nightmare at the same time. And that's kind of the history of technology, right? Mm. It opens up these immense possibilities, and it also creates its own sort of nightmares. And we're out of time or close to that, and I'm just going to ask you, closing, what do you want to say to this audience and to people who will be listening? Any parting words of wisdom from you?
They were pretty good. If I've learned anything in all my years of striving, it's to stop striving. You know, it's really hard. It's really hard, you know, especially here in San Francisco, where the human potential movement was born. You know, I look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs and see at the very top of it self-actualization. It's the last thing I want to do is actualize myself. I'm sick to death of myself. You know, and as long as we use that as the pinnacle of human potential, we can be marketed to death. We can be taken off taken out of our game. Human beings have a home field advantage on Earth with one another in concert, in solidarity. And the only way to get there is to kind of get yourself out of the way and start looking at human potential as a team sport. Rather than an individual activity.
Our thanks to Douglas Rushkoff. Thanks. Okay, I have to do this. Okay. Our thanks to Douglas Rushkoff, professor of media theory and digital economics at the City University of New York's Queens College, and the author of Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. I'm Marina Gorbis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, this place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Wow.